international finance law. We are looking at the largest international financial markets in the world and their structure and operation. We're considering all of the key aspects of the markets, all of the key practical and legal issues that arise, including specifically negotiation points. We're trying to understand how the international financial system works and how all of this fits together. This is a contracts class, it's a transaction class, it's a deal class. We're looking at the specific transactions which are conducted on each of these markets so that we do it from our office professional market perspective rather than from our regulatory perspective. The key point that arises simply is that these markets are so large, there is no single government or international agency big enough to manage the markets, so the markets essentially regulate themselves. It's a self-regulatory model, it's a market practice, a market professional model, specifically harmonized, managed through the international trade associations. The three principal trade associations are the Loan Market Association, the International Capital Markets Association, and the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. And what they do is prepare standard documentation and standard rules of practice to effectively govern, control these markets from the inside. It's an internal self-regulatory model. This creates an alternative, a proxy, a substitute for official external regulation. And we'll come back and look at this in further detail when we consider the slides. We are then considering the core markets. So we're looking at contract structures and finance options, relevant terms and conditions, related legal issues. We're going to consider this from the perspective of structure and documents, the parties and duties, rights and duties in each market, party liability, the legal limitation or exclusion of liability, and the remedies that arise. I have given you a large number of documents and we'll go over all of this again. On the historical development, you've got papers on the City of London, coffee houses, financial markets, Eurodollar markets, and the Bretton Woods system. You've got an overall general study pack, which explains the whole of the course, which we'll refer to again, and you've got a core document which summarises all of the key markets and all of the key points of interest and importance within that. With regards to the core markets themselves, we are focusing on loans and bonds. So we're looking at the euro loans, the euro bonds, the euro notes, commercial paper, and financial derivatives. Essentially, loans are bilateral loan-based credit or debit instruments between the borrower and either one bank or a group of banks. And it can be one borrower or other connected borrowers. This is a personal, bilateral, direct credit relationship, which is evidenced and recorded in the form of a loan agreement. That's the basis for the banking and loan markets. The opposite to that is the bond market, which are securities. In that case, the repayment obligation, the debt relationship, is created and evidenced in the form of a transferable security, which can then be bought and sold on the markets. The advantage then of the bond markets is that because they are inherently transferable as well as negotiable, which means that the acquiring party can obtain perfect title so long as that they obtained the bond without any prior notification of defect in title, that it's perfectly negotiable. This means that we have a large number of transfers in the market, a powerful secondary market, which increases market liquidity. So in the bond markets, if you have good credit standing, you can generally always borrow more and at a finer rate of coupon or finer rate of interest. So it's cheaper to borrow more in the capital markets. The historical development of the capital markets is then simply one of longer fixed term bonds, usually 20 years plus, medium term notes between 5, 15, 10 and 15 years. A note is distinct from a bond in that it's floating rate interest, and then you have shorter euro notes, usually 1 up to 3, maybe 5 years, although euro notes can go beyond 1 year. But principally, the main distinction is that if it's less than 1 year and if it's a wholesale instrument, we call that commercial paper. So commercial paper is up to 1 year, notes generally between 1 and 20, and bonds 20 plus, although technically the distinction between a loan, the distinction between a bond and a note is that the bond pays fixed interest and the note pays floating. In terms of the document itself, we need to understand this with regards to the key sets of provisions which are contained in all standard finance documentation. We will have the financial terms, we will have the conditions, and we have the events of default. The conditions are essentially precedent and subsequent, and then with precedent, that's pre-loan, conditions, precedent. We have the representations and warranties, which are pre-advance, and then we have the ongoing continuing covenants and obligations, which are post-advance, and we've looked at all of this in further detail, and we'll come back to that as we review all of the papers and documents available. We've then also got the syndication principles, the syndication relationship. We need to understand how the banks themselves, who make up the syndicate, their rights and duties inter se, and we can consider that in terms of five key sets of obligations: severality, equality, proportionality, democracy, and then limited agency function. And the limited agency function corresponds with the duties of the agent bank. These facilities, these transactions, these arrangements are set up by a lead bank or an arranging bank, both on the loan side as well as on the bond side. But we also have an agent bank who will administer the facility once it's up and running. So we've looked at a number of the key issues that arise in connection with this and all of the core issues that have to be considered from a legal perspective. We also then have summarised a number of the key points in the slides made available. And what we've got is this. We're considering this in terms of the principle, financial markets and instruments. We're distinguishing between the money markets, the banking markets, and the credit markets. We need to understand the nature of financial intermediation. Intermediation is whereby we have banks, which will include commercial banks, which do deposit-taking business, investment banks, which only do securities business, and then merchant banks, which combine both deposit-taking and trade finance and securities related functions. We also consider this in terms of financial risk, financial regulation, and then private contract and remedy. All of this is covered in the main introductory document that you have. This explains the distinction between the main markets, the money markets, the bank or credit markets, and the capital markets, and then again financial intermediation, risk, regulation, contract and remedy. We're also expanding that with this slide. In the money markets, the primary markets are the market that the central bank intervenes with a small select group of other major participants in the markets. So the primary money market, the central bank is involved. The secondary money markets are then transferring credit instruments between other wholesale market counterparties. In the capital markets, the primary market is the market where you bring the security to the market for the first time. The secondary markets are then the markets that deal, buy and sell in that security once it has been brought to the markets. We've also then looked at the capital markets in terms of debt, equity, warrants and hybrids, depository receipts and euro dollars. We've also considered the background and historical evolution, nature and content of the derivatives markets, and then other markets including the currency markets, gold and bullion and commodity markets. In terms of core language, core meaning and key definitions, it's very useful to understand each of the basic terms, to understand these and to be able to use these in your examination or in your professional discussion. So I've provided on this slide a series of course summary definitions. This is all taken from the main introductory paper to the course. So what is a market? Any identifiable location, system or formalised set of relations through which we can buy or sell any product or commodity. What is a financial market? Any organised process through which financial contracts or claims can be issued and traded. And then I go through exchange, stock market and exchange, a security, bank, financial function, financial intermediation, financial value, financial risk and financial regulation. It is very useful to have a clear understanding of all of these core terms and to be able to use this in your professional practice and in your academic work. The paper also summarises the key financial risks. We have financial risks, operational risks, legal risks, market risks, and then wider external or environmental risks. We refer briefly to the nature of financial regulation, although, as we've already explained, these markets are essentially self-regulated. They control themselves. They operate on an internal governance basis, principally using standard private law documentation as prepared by the key trade associations. I've included this just by way of explanation. We can understand financial rules in terms of financial regulation with regards to the financial rules, and then conduct or contract rules, and then the market rules which apply to the specific stock market exchange or OTC market that we're looking at. We then need to consider in further detail the advantages and potential limits of this self-regulatory model in the international finance area. So what we have is this. We're looking at international wholesale markets. We've got financial rules, conduct rules, and market rules. We're then going to look at how each of these are adjusted to apply in the international financial area. And then we're going to specifically assess the extent to which this can operate effectively on a self-management, self-control, self-regulatory basis. We're looking at formal market regulation and public international law. The principal point here simply is this. It's very difficult to agree international standards in highly sensitive core areas of function which are closely tied to the sovereign identity of a country. Anything that's tied to sovereign identity, exclusive control or territorial exclusivity, anything that impacts on this, governments are very reluctant to surrender control over, which would include adhering to any formal international treaty or convention. This would apply, for example, to areas such as military intervention, armaments, other specific types of military hardware, such as biological weapons. It also then extends to monetary systems and to the financial markets and financial system more generally. Countries are very reluctant to surrender control over this. It would therefore be very difficult in practice to agree a formal international treaty to establish any type of organised, structured control system for financial markets at the international level. It's because of these inherent limitations that we then have to consider the possible adoption of a self-regulatory model. The main participants in these markets include the main governments in the world, the largest countries, small and medium-sized countries, as well as the largest companies in the world. Because of that, it's very difficult to agree any formal international treaty or convention-based system. Therefore, we have to look at alternative options. I've tried to summarise that on the slide here. So it's politically, operationally and financially ineffective and impractical to try to design a formal treaty system for international financial regulation. We there have to look for a market, self-regulatory or membership-based model using private contract law so we can create a private contract law solution. And then develop this in terms of five further key points. A formal treaty-based system would be very costly, very expensive, and involve a very substantial amount of formality. Secondly, it would be politically sensitive and therefore highly difficult to agree any formalised treaty or convention-type model. Even if we did, countries would insist on national variation and national adjustment, which always happens in international negotiations. The effect of that then is that the system will always only be partial, incomplete and uneven. Even if we could agree this, we still lack effective international oversight. There's no effective mechanism, so what we're going to have in practice is an inconsistent, incoherent and possibly conflicted model. And even if we did have effective oversight, there is no sanction or enforcement mechanism so that we can actually discipline the largest countries in the world to adhere to this, to ensure strict compliance over time. There's no effective private or sovereign sanction. An international treaty model then displays a large number of inherent limitations, and because of that we have to consider possible alternative models, and that's why we look at self-regulation. We can then design a separate wholesale market, self-governing, self-control, self-management model, essentially based on professional trade association involvement. The key advantages: this reflects core market practice. We have improved risk management. We can use standard documentation, which we can prepare in advance so that everyone is clear of all of their rights and obligations. It also involves industry representation so that we can ensure that it's timely, relevant, and of practical use and value. And then we can also involve industry representation to develop this and revise this over time. And then we can publish all of this. So we have full transparency as well. In terms of market self-regulatory advantage, we can summarise this in terms of five key points. It's expert and relevant, essentially because it's market professionally designed and structured. It's immediate and integral. We can incorporate all of these rights and duties into private law contracts. It's flexible and responsive. We have continuous revision in response to any market changes or market disruption. We have cost and ease of revision. We can do that through either simple documentation revision, change, or rulebook amendment. And then it's based on voluntary adoption and compliance, which promotes self-interest. The content is then based on self-interest with an internal culture of compliance, which encourages adoption and adherence and compliance. Now, there are some potential stated limitations with this model. So, for example, we have maybe potential conflicts of interest, lack of transparency, possibly anti-competitive systems. There's no wider public interest involvement. And then there's arguably no systemic control mechanism, although we'll come back and re-examine that, reconsider that. What we could also then do is this: we could develop some of these ideas further. If we're trying to explain the characteristics of the international financial system and international financial markets, to try and identify the key elements within this which allow this self-regulatory model to work, how would we do that? I've come up with 12 separate key points. Firstly, the market has a limited number of participants. There's only a small number of countries, essentially around 211 in the world, with all of the very large corporate participants, counterparties in this market, and other professional counterparties. The market is essentially limited in total size. It's also, secondly, highly professional. It only involves governments, which are represented by official bodies, as well as its the other investors are of a professional or expert nature. Thirdly, we've got continuing legal advice. Because of the large value of the transactions involved and the public and professional nature of the transactions, almost all of the counterparties in this area will be professionally legally advised. Point four, we have the involvement of these trade associations. The main banks, securities firms, insurance companies, or other participants in any particular market, they come together, they form their own interest group, their own trade group, which is the trade association. It then acts as a focus for understanding the market and for developing best practice and best documentation, standard documentation in these markets. Point five, the use of the documentation itself then allows everyone in the market to understand the expectations of all other participants in the market. So we have a pre-agreed set of standard terms and conditions. Some of the detail can be negotiated clearly, but the overall effect of the using standard documentation is that you get a very clearly well-structured, transparent market that everyone understands in advance. We've also then got the use of, in the documentation itself, we will have specific governing law clauses, so we incorporate legal systems which are attuned to managing high-value commercial and financial disputes and are capable of resolving all of the core issues involved. Very often there'll be a substantial body of case law or other principle, documentation or literature that can support the understanding and explanation of each of the key terms and ideas involved. We've also got jurisdiction clauses in all of the main documents. We will select a specific jurisdiction to determine disputes in the event that this arises. The two most commonly used jurisdictions are London and New York, which is why a lot of practitioners will become admitted in under English law and under New York law, because most of the disputes are referred to those fora for resolution. Even if a separate governing law is selected, for example in Saudi Arabia or Japan, you can still have New York or London act as the core jurisdiction. This again adds to the certainty, validity, verifiability, all of which promotes confidence and trust in this market and market system. Also again, if we're using these specific jurisdictions, we know that we will be able to enforce any court orders which are issued, because we will have reciprocal enforcement around the world, in particular where these are produced by New York or English courts. We can then identify a series of other points on top of all of this. So point number 9 would be, it's the large size of the market. So it's an important market, which means government and other market observers are monitoring this, including the media and market analysts within the market system. We've also then got the importance of the market. This would be point number 10. Again, for this reason, all of the key participants in the market, including the governments and the central banks, are monitoring this. We will have continuing oversight, which is point 11, and then point 12 is we will in effect have a form of implied contingent market support, effectively a residual lender of last resort in the event that difficulties arise, simply because of those key points that I've just made in terms of the large size, the importance of the market, and the need for continuing monitoring by media, market analysts and other market counterparties. The effect of all of this is that if any major disruption does arise, the central banks are expected to intervene when appropriate. We actually saw that in September 2022. A major disruption arose in the markets after the then Conservative government in the United Kingdom announced a budget plan that hadn't been pre-costed through the Office of Budget Responsibility. As a result of that, it made the markets very nervous indeed. There was a sharp increase in bond and borrowing costs for the UK government, collapse in the value of sterling. The Bank of England then intervened in certain limited ways to support the markets and to protect the markets. So while there is no formal established lender of last resort system and support for this market in practice, it has to be implied that where there is major instability in these markets because of their size and because of their importance, the authorities will step in and take necessary appropriate action. We can then develop this further by looking in particular detail at the key trade associations. So in the loan area, with the Loan Market Association, we can understand its establishment, its historical development. It was originally set up in 1996 with 400 members, although that's substantially been extended since. We can summarise its purpose, board, governance, committees and documentation. I've also provided a series of separate notes on this, which I'll provide in a minute. We have the International Capital Markets Association, the ICMA. It was originally set up as the Association for International Brokers and Dealers. It changed its name to the International Securities and Markets Association in 1991, and then it merges the International Securities and Markets Association with the International Primary Markets Association to become the International Capital Markets Association. We can summarise its purpose, governance committees, documentation and handbooks again. And then the third principal trade association is the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA. It was originally chartered in 1985 with 800 members and 56 countries, that's since extended again. The main involvement, its main contribution, is in terms of developing master agreements. The 1992 and the 2002 are the two key documents with their support annexes. These essentially create a standard documentation model for use in the OTC derivatives area. We've also got another series of supporting functions which is has developed over time in terms of confirmations, definitions, opinions, and then other protocols and adherence letters. What I've also provided on the system is a series of separate notes. This is on the Loan Market Association. It looks at the background, nature, as well as advantages, committee structure, frequently asked questions, as well as recommended documents and subsequent development. I've provided a parallel note on the International Capital Markets Association, history of the Eurobond market, ICMA mission, and ICMA structure and regional governance arrangements. And then again, I've provided another separate set of notes on the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, mission, documentation, master agreements, frequently asked questions. For all of these are linked back to the key websites and the key information provided in the outline document for the course. With all of this, we can understand how the international financial markets work and operate, how they are essentially governed without the need for formal external official intervention through the alternative construction of a market-based or self-regulatory model. This essentially operates through these key trade associations, and their core function is to monitor market practice and then develop a sort of consolidated reconciliation form of best practice, which is then reflected either in the standard documentation produced by these associations or their own rule books or other recommended best practices and papers and guidelines provided on their systems. And with all of this, we can understand how the international financial system of itself more generally works and how all of this comes together in practice.